Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to World Affairs, a channel of the New Books Network podcast. I'm Sharika Crawford, your host. Today I'm here with Dr. Nadia Nur Hussain. She's an associate professor of English and Africana Studies at Johns Hopkins University. We're here to discuss her book, Black Land, Imperial Ethiopianism in African America, published by Princeton University Press. Welcome to New Books in World Affairs, Nadia.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for agreeing to the interview. Let us begin with you sharing a bit about your intellectual and professional background.
Sure. So I got my PhD at UC Berkeley in English. And when I applied to grad school, I really did not have any idea I would end up where I am now. My plan was at that time to study modern and contemporary American poetry. I've always been interested in poetry. I wrote poetry. It's kind of been on the back burner lately, but that's always been my passion. And so even from my very early childhood, I knew poetry was what I was interested in. So I went off to grad school thinking that's what I would do. And I did end up doing that for some time. I kind of was grappling for a possible dissertation topic. And I ended up being interested in the topic that ended up also being my first book, which was American poetry written in dialect. So I was kind of interested in how writers chose to represent what they considered non-standard speech. I also ended up sort of moving chronologically backward in terms of the period that interested me. So ever since working on my dissertation, I've been focused mainly on late 19th, early 20th century literature. So with that first book, I ended up writing about both white and Black American writers. But I became more and more interested in, for some reason, the writer Paul Laurence Dunbar. He was sort of the center of that book. I ended up actually writing, I think, two chapters about him. There was one poem of his that I didn't end up writing about in that book called Ode to Ethiopia. And it was from that poem that I decided, okay, I think there might be the seed of another project here. And that's what became my second book.
It's clear when those of us who have had the opportunity to read your work that you front and center a lot of poetry by well-known kind of American writers, particularly African American writers, but also American writers at large, but also lesser known figures, at least for those of us who don't study poetry or our literary studies background. Paul Laurence Dunbar, he's such a pivotal figure when you think about 20th century African American literature, and it's clear from your reading of him in your book that he it makes sense that he drew you to this topic. And for our listeners who are not familiar yet with your book, how might you describe the late 19th into the 20th century engagement, cultural and literary and intellectual engagement from African Americans to Ethiopia at a pivotal time in its own history?
Yeah, so as I said, I kind of began with this textual, prompt of Dunbar's poem. But when I started thinking about how he was talking about Ethiopia, I realized, well, you know, you see this a lot in just African-American literature in general, these references to Ethiopia, which a lot of people have looked at as basically abstractions, as kind of ways of talking about the race generally, or ways of talking about Africa generally. And so I wanted to kind of think about, well, what specifically was happening when, you know, for example, Dunbar was writing his poem? What could he have been responding to in world history? And what might he have known about the specific country of Ethiopia? What did Ethiopia mean to him concretely? And so that was one of the driving questions behind the book, was to think about, well, you know, what is happening in late 19th century world history? What's happening in Ethiopian military history? One of the battles that I talk about period, you know, throughout the book is the Battle of Adwa in 1896, which was for the world, but, you know, especially for African Americans, a really important turning point in the understanding of, well, lots of things. But for example, this, I mentioned, you know, this kind of reading of the battle as a kind of overturning of white supremacy, of this ideology that, you know, there is no such thing as Black civilization, you know. And so this is this kind of concrete example that a lot of people have talked about as this humiliating defeat of, that's the word a lot of people use, humiliating defeat of Italian military forces trying to colonize the country that was then known as Abyssinia. Like I said, it became a kind of important symbol for a lot of people of a Black country defeating a white country, what Ethiopia could offer to Black people around the world.
One of the things that drew me to your book, just looking at the title originally, was my own interest in this kind of long engagement that African Americans, both elite and non-elite, have had with international spaces of Black models of modernity or independence or freedom, whether we're talking about first Haiti and Liberia, Ethiopia being another example, and even Ghana later in the 20th century. And you do a really wonderful job for me as a historian who has to teach world history and teach this period of the age of modern imperialism. And in addition to kind of thinking of Ethiopia as a symbol for African Americans at that time, you point out, you know, they were a concrete people and it's a concrete place. But more importantly, you focus on this concept of a diasporic empire. And I was very appreciative of how you showcase that this was very complicated, because as you point out, the Battle of Adwa is something that in world history we celebrate as the defeat of white supremacy. Look at Ethiopia being one of two places that wasn't colonized during this period of European expansionism. And yet you point out that there's this imperial project happening within the country of Ethiopia that may or may not be fully appreciated you know, by the African American community that's engaging with this concept of Ethiopia over the latter part of the 19th into the 20th century.
Yeah, I think that's one of the things I wanted to really elaborate on in the book, that even with this, you know, as I said, kind of attempt to engage with Ethiopia in a concrete way, to understand the history of Ethiopia among African Americans, you still have this, sort of persistent romanticism around the country. And I think the examples of Haiti and Liberia, while, you know, obviously imperfect republics, they're still not at this time, you know, engaging in the sort of imperial expansionism that Ethiopia was. And so that's why I wanted to kind of focus on the question of empire as it applies to Ethiopia. Whereas, you know, a lot of people were at the time thinking of the defense of Ethiopia as an anti-imperialist project. Well, at the same time, Ethiopia was, you know, engaging in a lot of the atrocities that you see in African colonialism in general. And so I wanted to kind of talk a little bit about that in the book. One thing I forgot to mention at the top of the interview is that I am Ethiopian American. That's another reason why I've been interested in this topic. And so I have seen, you know, from family members and friends of the family, how Ethiopian empire, works within the country, prior to 1974, when Selassie was overthrown. But, you know, that, you know, my parents grew up in an imperial Ethiopia. And so I have this sort of personal connection to what it meant within the country to be a subject of Ethiopian empire.
One of the things that I think is really powerful as an anchor for that thread of your book, that part of your book that you're trying to kind of focus on with regards to this dualism of Ethiopia, both as a site of anti-imperialism, but one that is an expanding empire, was the way that you used these three pivotal emperors across the time period in which your study, your book, focuses on Emperor, hopefully I'm pronouncing it correctly, Tewodros, Menelik II, and Haile Selassie, which probably many more listeners may be familiar with, considering he lived into the 20th century. How did you kind of know ahead of time that there were going to be these anchor points that kind of grappling with Ethiopia as a concrete place and an empire across the period of your book's study?
No, I didn't actually. It's interesting that you should ask that, because that sort of happened through the writing process. I did know that there were particular battles and wars that I wanted to talk about. So I had this kind of military framework that I wanted to think about. And that was one of the interventions that I wanted to make, is to kind of go back beyond the Battle of Adwa and kind of think about the Anglo-Abyssinian War in the 1860s as a moment that made Ethiopia visible to the rest of the world. But in kind of looking at these military moments, I realized that these figures, the figures of the emperors, ended up kind of becoming larger than life. And I don't think it's an accident, because I think that that is what a lot of people, a lot of readers at the time would have engaged with as a way of understanding what was happening. So I used the example of, a lot of the political cartoons and caricatures of Tewodros, for example, in Punch and La Lune. And these are ways that readers of periodicals, basically got this journalistic information filtered through these visual images. And so I did want to kind of talk about personalities that became important in how people understood Ethiopian Empire. And of course, you know, the emperors are, they have this sort of larger than life way that they color the way people understand the country.
And in fact, when we think about Ethiopia, or we try to construct, you know, historical narratives, I mean, they are prominent. You know, we know those names, or we've heard those names, even if we don't have a full texture of their personalities and perhaps their complicated and inconsistent renderings within the country at large. I wanted to follow up our conversation about the origins of this project and the way in which you're connecting, you know, the concrete Ethiopia and African Americans' understandings of it with this term that you use, and it's used widely, you know, with other scholars, but perhaps you can help us have a firmer understanding of it. What should we take by the meaning of Ethiopianism? What is the kind of concept really referring to?
Yeah, so as you point out, a term that has been used by a lot of scholars and goes back to the 19th century. And understanding it is, let me take a step back and say that I think that the way that it has been typically understood is much more abstracted than the way I'm trying to use it in the book, right? Because I am kind of looking at how Ethiopia figures specifically, as I said, in people's understanding of it as a kind of representation for a kind of Black ideal empire. I think that a lot of definitions in the past have kind of seen it as an extension of this, the Bible reference, right? The biblical reference to Ethiopia, it shall extend its arms. I can't remember now exactly how it goes, but you know, that Ethiopia shall basically rise again, right? This idea of resurrection, I think, is implicit in the term Ethiopianism, right? That there's this idea that the country, or you know, that Ethiopia is not what it once was, but it will be again. And I think that's kind of the crux of Ethiopianism.
Which, as you point out, I mean, it would be particularly appealing to you know, African Americans in the United States, you know, thinking of Ethiopia as the source of redemption for, as you pointed out, sometimes Ethiopian or Abyssinian as being kind of a generic term for the African race or the Black race in all its complexities, for using such terminology. And therefore, it makes sense that Ethiopia would serve as a model if we're thinking about redemption and resurrection in that way. I was hoping that we might delve a little bit into your book, just give our listeners a sense of some of the discussion that you had there. And there were so many to choose from. You have these beautiful 8 chapters, much of which I think is more appreciated when you read it because of the textual sources that you use. And you cover a number of kind of well-known literary figures whom engaged in Ethiopianism, whether we're talking about your chapter on Langston Hughes or Claude McKay or even the founder and editor of the Pittsburgh Courier, African-American newspaper, George Schuyler. But I thought that we might want to discuss some lesser-known figures. And these are African-Americans who engage with Imperial Ethiopia in your chapter titled Imperial Embellishment. And I was hoping that you would be able to elaborate a bit about Harry Foster Dean and William Henry Ellis. Some of our listeners may be familiar more with him. There was a recent book about him as the first Black, I guess, man on Wall Street, who sought to kind of build their own sort of Ethiopian empires, inventing themselves in various ways connected to Imperial Ethiopia. I thought that that might be a very interesting conversation to have you flesh that out a little bit for our listeners.
Yeah, thank you. I think generally in both of my books, I've been really interested in talking about very well-known figures and alongside somewhat neglected figures or maybe even unknown figures. There are probably writers and other sort of historical figures, even less well-known than Ellis and Dean. As you point out, Ellis did have a biography written about him by Carl Jacoby, was it last year or a couple of years ago? So I think, you know, there's been a little bit of attention to both of these figures, but they're still very much understudied. I have become especially interested in Harry Foster Dean lately, and I think that the next project I work on will definitely involve Harry Foster Dean in some way. I kind of, in the way that Dunbar was like a kind of hinge figure for me in my first and second books, I see Dean as sort of what's getting me to the third book, fingers crossed. Harry Foster Dean was a really fascinating figure who wrote an autobiography in the 1920s. About a time in his life around the turn of the century when he was traveling around the world, but mainly based in Cape Town and attempting from that vantage point to establish what he was calling an Ethiopian empire. So he was using the term Ethiopian in that more general sense of meaning African or Black empire. But he had that as his main goal, and he saw himself as somehow ordained to be the one who would found this empire. In his time throughout Africa, he met with a lot of people from different, ethnic groups and tried to forge connections between them, even if, you know, he knew that there was a history of tension between, you know, two groups. He would try to foster in some way solidarity that was racial, right? And so he saw himself as being African American, as somebody who could somehow mediate all of these African groups and create a place, a territory for Black people around the world to consider home. And so he had a lot of, opportunities, chances to try to start this project, and at every turn he was basically thwarted. By the end of the autobiography, he's been thrown out of Africa. He even says at one point that Sir Harry Johnston called him the most, quote, most dangerous Negro in the world. So he was perceived, at least he thought that he was perceived as a threat to imperialists who felt that, you know, he was in danger of gaining too much power. He had to be thrown out.
And how does his use of like this kind of concept of imperial Ethiopia differ from someone like William Henry Ellis?
Yeah, so one of the things I talk about in that chapter is that Abyssinia, the country that was known as Abyssinia at the time, is strangely absent from Dean's autobiography, and other evidence suggests that he did go to Ethiopia, and he claimed to, you know, I think he said he met Menelik, and he had connections with Ethiopia beyond just even knowing about the country, because he did have a very good understanding of Africa for the time. And so I think it's a strange omission that he is thinking about Ethiopian Empire, but doesn't acknowledge that there is an Ethiopian Empire already. I think that's an important difference, because Ellis actually did go to Ethiopia as part of a U.S. mission and brought a treaty to Menelik, met with Menelik, and supposedly, although it's not quite clear, one of his obituaries said that he was he wanted to oust Menelik. He also later on claimed that Menelik had granted him a duchy. So he had these very clear connections to Abyssinia in a way that Dean, if he did have them, obscures them in the autobiography.
Mm. You point out later in the book, and it serves as a contrast to Dean and Ellis, who, whether they directly engage with the real Ethiopian Empire or not, there was definitely a lack of concern, or they didn't have a problem with the project of an imperial state, even one in which they want to engage with or replicate or serve as an inspiration. But that African American openness to embrace of imperial Ethiopia changes later in the 20th century, you seem to be suggesting and arguing. And perhaps that might be a way to kind of conclude that thread of your book's argument. I was thinking maybe of Langston Hughes, who had a little bit more of a complicated set of interactions with Imperial Ethiopia.
Yeah, that is what I found in reading, that it seemed like something was becoming a little bit more complicated for people in the 30s, like writers who were beginning to see things that maybe were not ideal in Ethiopian Empire, in this model of Ethiopian Empire. And so, Langston Hughes is for me a figure that illustrates this really well, because you can see the sort of complex interactions in his writing, where, you know, there are definitely moments where he's critical of Haile Selassie, certainly, in his poetry. And I give the example of when in 1966 he actually goes to Ethiopia and writes a poem and presents it to Haile Selassie, and feels really that the whole interaction was so off-putting, because it was to him this kind of really disgusting display of the imperial. So that's kind of what I discovered as I was reading, writing from the 30s and onward, that it starts to become much more critical of this idea of Ethiopia.
I was thinking that your work, particularly where we live here, we work in both of you and you know, both of us work in Maryland. We live and work within this DC Baltimore metropolitan area where we have a sizable Ethiopian American community and sizable African American community. How do you think your book, your work kind of showing those historical links of these kind of cultural and literary interactions, whether they were imaginary or they were real, how do you think this might be received in these types of communities where we live?
I hope it will be received with interest, and I've gotten some feedback already from well, especially family members, because of course, you know, they want to support me. but you know, I think even Ethiopians and Ethiopian Americans in general who have contacted me seem really interested in this topic. I've heard from people who live in Ethiopia too, who have been really curious about it. So, and I think, yeah, in the DC Maryland area, certainly there's a large, you know, Ethiopian diaspora community. I am really eager for the book to end up in the hands of people who live around here and to hear what they think. But yeah.
No, yeah, I think, you know, I think that oftentimes, one, in the United States publicly, we don't spend a lot of attention understanding the various interactions between continental Africans and their experiences in America alongside, you know, American-born people of African descent. In areas where you do find those two large communities, particularly in recent years, it's often depicted fraught, you know, tense. And not to say that there are not moments and, you know, in places where that had happened, but I think your book allows for a longer view and kind of an opportunity to kind of have a more expansive, wider understanding of different kinds of interactions, particularly among many of the people that you studied were not necessarily able to go to Imperial Ethiopia, but yet they were very deeply engaged with and reading periodicals and, you know, writing, you know, fictionalized, you know, accounts or sometimes what they thought ethnic, as you point out, ethnographical accounts or plays. I think that could be a powerful tool in shaping those types of communities, which don't often have the opportunity to see in these kinds of lights.
Yeah, thank you for saying that. I think, you know, certainly from the other, you know, point of view, like you said, of Ethiopian Americans that I've talked to, there's at least more than a couple of people have expressed surprise to me that there was this level of engagement among African Americans, that they knew what was happening in Ethiopia in, you know, the 1860s or 1890s, I think is surprising to a lot of Ethiopians who maybe didn't realize that, you know, that there was such a, you know, so much information out there, that there was so much media attention to Ethiopia at these moments, I think is surprising to people. And so these connections are very deep and go back such a long time to, you know, such a long way. I think that's easy to forget sometimes, that we, you know, have these sort of interconnected, you know, relations. So, yeah.
Nadia, I usually conclude my interviews asking about current or future projects, and you did give us a little bit of a hint that you think Harry Foster Dean is a lynch or kind of going to be like a pinch in your next project. But would you like to share with us maybe something, you know, you're currently working on or something that we should look out for in terms of any upcoming publications?
Well, I mean, one thing that I would really like to do, and it's still you know, I'm not sure if it'll be possible, but I'm fingers crossed, is put out a critical edition of Harry Dean's autobiography, because I think more people should read it. And it's currently not really easily accessible. I'm also working on a future, but it's a very, very early stages, but I'm hoping to work on a project that looks at connection, the intersections between oceanic studies and Black diasporic studies. And that's where I think Harry Dean will be an important figure for that project. So, and in a way that I guess is now becoming a pattern, I want to look at not just abstractions of the transatlantic, but the actual Atlantic, the actual oceans that he traveled, because he talks about well, not just the Atlantic, but sailing to the Pacific and you know, throughout, just basically circumnavigating the globe when he was a young teenager. And so I think in a lot of literary studies, there can be this sort of neglect of the actual work of sailors. And that's something that I know that you, from the perspective of a historian, have worked on. But I think what I'd like to do is look at literary texts that deal with the ocean. And yeah, so that's kind of, like I said, at the very beginning stages, but that's where I'm hoping to go next.
Oh no, I'm looking forward to it. When I read that chapter about Harry Foster Dean, I immediately scribbled down the title of his text, because it sounded so fascinating, and as you point out, hasn't quite received the level of attention that probably is warranted. So it's exciting to hear about these current projects that you have underway. I want to thank you again for this interview with the World Affairs Channel.
Thank you so much for having me. It was great to talk to you.
You can find a link to Black Land, Imperial Ethiopianism in African America on New Books Network and World Affairs Channel. Until next time.